Welcome to Registry Matters, an independent production. Our opinions are our own, and we don't take instructions from anyone but us. We are thankful for the support of our patrons. You make what we do here possible. And always remember, FYP.
Recording live from FYP Studios East and West. Transmitting across the internet, this is episode 385 of Registry Matters. Larry, it's a Saturday evening. How are you?
Doing awesome. I sure missed you last week. Where were you?
Oh my God, dude. I just showed somebody a picture. Like, it's hard to describe, but so I have a standing desk because, you know, it's good for you. I mean, I sit here all day. I'm here for 12, 14 hours a day doing day job stuff. And my watch says, hey, it's time for you to stand. I was like, okay, I'll stand. And I press the button and it goes, no. And I had to reset it, and to reset it, you have to lower the desk all the way down to the very bottom, which is seriously, you could almost sit on the floor. And if you're watching the video, like my arms are just up to my shoulders. Like you could almost work on it sitting on the floor. And then, so I get it down all the way down and resets, it's leveled and all this stuff. And then I press up and only the right side starts going up. Only the right side. And I was like, that's not good. And I mean, everything is like bolted and screwed down on the desk. I wasn't really worried about anything falling. And so I was like, well, maybe we should try to reset it again. And so I pressed the two buttons to reset it, and it just went straight down. It, at its angle, it went straight down, and it got down to the bottom. It's like, okay, I'm reset. And I was like, that's not reset. And I pressed up, and it got worse. So it's like at a 45-degree angle. And I have to buy a desk. I can't work that way. I tried putting, I have a floor jack and jack stands in the garage. So I got that out. I like tried to jack up the desk to get it to be flat. It was just a complete shit show. It was a mess.
I won't ask you if that was funny.
It's not funny. And so I'm like, as much shit as I have on my desk, it took me all, I went up to IKEA and I bought two desks and got them figured out together that are almost the same size of the desk that I had. And then for me to bring everything back in here, it was not 8 o'clock Saturday night by the time I had my computer back on before I could even like look at anything. Forget the monitors, forget keyboards, forget button pushers, cameras, lights, nothing. Just 8 o'clock before I like powered the thing on for the first time. It was a mess.
Well, all righty. Well, I'm sorry that that happened.
Yeah, you know, hey, whatever. So now I don't have a standing desk. Now I'm back to the peasant land of having to just sit here in one static position. I'm going to have to actually get up and walk around to get my steps in, or when my watch says stand up, I'm going to have to do something and go take a walk or something. All right. Well, so what are we doing tonight?
We have a case from the United States District Court, Northern District of Florida. It's quite fascinating. In addition, we plan to briefly discuss the situation in New Mexico of former representative Cheryl Williams Stapleton that somehow landed on your radar way across the country. And also we have a topic that was interesting on the NARSOL listserv about a campaign donation from a PFR.
All right, that sounds interesting on its own.
One man in Indiana, no lawyer, no law degree, and a state that decided his finished 10-year term should suddenly last forever. He walked into federal court alone and walked out with an injunction. Andy and Larry break down exactly how he did it. Registry Matters is a nonprofit, and your support literally funds this fight. Become a patron at patreon.com/registrymatters.
And all right, well then let us begin. So we're going to talk about this former state representative person.
Yeah, unless you want to do the Sun-Times first with the representative. I meant the representative, the campaign donation that was made by the PFR.
You tell me whichever one you want to do first.
Yeah, let's do Bailey first.
Okay, so, Darren Bailey.
So,
yeah, go ahead.
This is an article from the Chicago Sun-Times, and it generated quite a bit of discussion exchanges because the Republican candidate for governor, Darren Bailey, received a donation from a person who has a sex offense conviction, but they now pastor a church. And of all the ungodly things, candidate Bailey attended a service at that church with a PFR in the pulpit.
The horror.
And so when the itche hit the fan, when it became public, then candidate Bailey announced he was giving the donation to charity. And everybody opined on the listserv that he should have just grown a pair and and stood up for what was right and said, I did it. I'm not, and I took the donation. I'm glad to have the person participating in my campaign. And I tried to explain why that wasn't a good stance for a person to take.
I need you to go back. You said a word. You said itche. Could you elaborate on that?
Itche.
And then you said another word. You said, oh, grow a pair. That was the other one. Do you want to describe what that means for those in the audience that may not have a pair or not know how to grow one if they are desiring to?
Well, I'm not sure how you would grow a pair if you don't have them. But in terms of the itche, that's Pig Latin. Did you ever speak Pig Latin when you were in school?
No, I'm not that sophisticated to know how to speak Ligpatin.
So, okay, sounds like you do. Well, back in the day, for those who are under 40, back in the day, we didn't have texting capacity, and we had to have a coded way to discuss things so that adults wouldn't know what we were talking about.
Oh, yeah, I'm sure they didn't know what you were saying.
Of course, but that was what we thought. But of course, they knew exactly what we were saying. But you reverse the syllables with a little bit of extra A, E. I mean, not A, E. So if you were going to pronounce F-U-C-K, it would be Akfe.
Okay. All right. Please continue.
If you were going to pronounce Y-O-U, it would be Ouye.
Oh, Ouye. Ouye, ouye.
So it would be Akfe Ouye.
Okay. I think we just left. I'm going to have to put an E on the program now.
So, but anyway, this is the governorship candidacy in Illinois. Now, the incumbent has virtually no chance of losing. It would be a miracle for Governor Pritzker to lose with all the funding he has from his family. And the fact that it's a heavily Democratic state, except for a few slivers, but it's largely a Democratic state. So it'd be an extreme long shot. But the reason why Darren Bailey did what he did is because that's what he had to do to get the mob off of his back. The mob is the people that start bugging him about why he's associating with a PFR, somebody convicted of a vile sex offense. And so Mr. Bailey has a choice to make, whether he's going to concentrate on messaging what his governorship would look like, or he's going to undertake a campaign of trying to convince the public that they should like former PFRs. Well, that's an easy choice for a candidate to make. It's not complicated, like people have tried to make it. It's a simple choice. Do I want to be distracted by this, or do I want to put it behind me?
I would imagine you'd want it to go away as quickly as possible.
And the way to make it go away is to either return it to the donor or to give it to charity. And that's what candidate Bailey chose to do. Now, I'm not defending the fact that the public, we the people, are not very forgiving. And despite our Christian, Judeo-Christian values, that we proclaim forgiveness and second chances, we really don't do that. That is horrible that we don't. But I'm telling you from a political perspective, he did what he felt like he had to do. And that helps get the issue moved off front and center so he can get on with attempting to unseat the incumbent governor. That's what he's doing. I'm not voting for him. I don't live there. I'm not supporting him. But this is the explanation of why he did what he did.
Would you, like, but who cares? Like, all kinds of dirty people donate money to different campaigns. Who cares that this person received a donation from this individual?
Well, it would be internal to the campaign to the Pritzker organization. They would be watching the campaign filings, and they'd be running names. And perhaps they were tipped off by someone who recognized the name, or perhaps they just started running names. But they discovered that this guy had the conviction, and they wanted to smear him. That's what they want to do. This came straight from the Democrat Party in Illinois, in all likelihood.
Is there an angle for the other guy to try to do something similar, to find anybody who's got dirt to say, oh, well, you took campaign donations from these terrible people too?
Well, yes, if he has the financial resources to do that. Pritzker is well-funded. I don't know. I don't live in Illinois. I don't know how well-funded Bailey is. When you're in a minority situation, and if it's considered by the Republican National Committee to be an unwinnable race, you generally don't get a lot of funds from out of state. So I suspect that Bailey is coming up very short on money. But he would absolutely be able to do that. He could do the same thing. But then that puts politics down in the mud barrel where it shouldn't be. We should be talking about issues. And this is really not an issue. This guy's pastoring a church. The crime happened, I think the article said, when he was 17, maybe? A long, long time ago.
Well, the title says, a 17-year-old girl. Now, I didn't read through in the early 2000s. I don't know that it says how old he was at the time.
So,
but whatever. Okay. As you just said, we should be talking about the issues, like the cost of gas or whether we should be, you know, throwing bombs into other countries and what, like, those are the things that we should be discussing. And at a state level, like, those wouldn't even really be the conversations other than gas prices and food prices. And can we get a crosswalk at some particular intersection? Those would be your state level issues.
Public schools, university level funding, the correctional system in Illinois. There'd be a lot of state issues you could talk about. Medicaid reform. There's on and on things that states are responsible for doing. But they do this, folks, because it works.
Sure.
It's kind of like the example I gave on the listserv when I responded several times, I think three times total. They used to do this with same-sex marriage. The people from the conservative side of the aisle, now this happens not to be coming from the conservatives, it's coming from the liberal side of the aisle, but the conservative side of the aisle would say, God made Adam and Eve, not Adam and Steve, and marriage is a holy matrimony between one man and one woman. And you could get a rounding standing ovation in many parts of the country. You can no longer do that because we the people have changed where we are. Now you're going to get booed off of the stage in most parts of the country if you do that, if you were to give that speech today. When we the people decide if we could flood the Democrat Party's phone lines with tens of thousands of phone calls and emails saying how repugnant we find this and that we might just change our vote because of this, this would stop. But until we the people change where we are, this is not going to go away.
A Michigan man reported his address change early, trying to do everything right. The previous tenant would not move out. He was 19 days off, and the state prosecuted him for it. That overreach may now unravel convictions for a whole class of people. Patrons get extra content, and a single dollar a month unlocks all of it. Go to patreon.com/registrymatters.
Gotcha. All right. Well, then. All right. So while I was driving home from New York today, I fired up the shortwave radio and I heard a little news segment about something out of New Mexico that I brought to your attention that we should talk about.
Yes, you did. And I'm surprised. Is it on shortwave now? They're talking about this. I thought it was just in traditional media.
How am I going to pick up New Mexico news while I'm driving down the interstate? So, yeah, it came up on shortwave. I was picking up your local radio station over there.
So, was it KKOB?
That's not what I heard it's called, but yes, that's what it was. Yes.
Or was it Klan radio?
It was an extra K in there, if I'm not mistaken.
All right. So, let's talk about this.
All right.
Well, you've got to set it up.
Okay, well, this is former New Mexico State Representative. Oh, this is here. Oh, never mind. Sorry. And so this story is out of Albuquerque, and it says, after a 9-day trial, a federal jury convicted former State Representative Cheryl Williams Stapleton and her friend Joseph Johnson on all counts with which they were charged, stemming from a years-long scheme in which Stapleton used her position at Albuquerque Public Schools and in the legislature to steer millions of dollars in funding to Johnson's company and secretly received approximately $1.15 million from the company. And what is this about? I thought politics was all clean in the land of enchantment.
Not really. this trial was one of the biggest trials we've had in some time, and I didn't follow it with the intensity that I probably should have. But according to court documents and evidence presented at the trial, from about July 2013 through June of 2021, Stapleton used her position at Albuquerque Public Schools as director of the Perkins Project in Career and Technical Education. Now, I don't know what that is, but Career and Technical Education makes a little bit of sense to me. She was the coordinator of Career and Technical Education to direct approximately 40% of APS's non-personal CTE personnel. Is that personnel? Yeah, personnel, CTE funding to Robotics Management Learning Systems of Washington, D.C., owned by and operated by Mr. Johnson, her co-defendant.
Yeah, and the government says the funds were for the CyberQuest software in APS classrooms. From 2013 through 2021, APS paid Robotics approximately $3.25 million under contracts for the software and related services, including approximately $2.52 million in federal Perkins funds. What are Perkins funds?
I don't know. They tried to describe that on the stories, but it went over my head. I'm not smart enough. But during that time, Stapleton served as New Mexico State Representative for District 19, a seat that she held from 1995 through 2021, and was the majority floor leader from 2017 through 2021. Now, that's the person who runs the calendar, calls bills up for discussion, leads on people to vote a certain way. But while serving the legislature, she sponsored and advocated for legislation and capital outlays that directed additional funding to APS for CTE programs. She then used her position at APS to direct CTE funding to Robotics and facilitate contracts for the company through procurement exemptions, sole source contracts, and later a request for proposal. Sole source contracts, I'm not really clear on, but I think it's where you don't have to put it out for a proposal. If it's less than a certain amount, you can just sign. And if it's above a certain amount, you have to do an RFP, I think, is the way it works.
All right. And then the story goes along and says, AP's CTE official, Stapleton, reviewed and approved Robotics invoices and directed employees under her supervision to approve them. APS issued checks to Robotics and mailed them to a post office box in Albuquerque. Stapleton personally retrieved APS's checks from the post office box and deposited them into the Robotics bank account. Johnson provided blank checks from the Robotics business account, which Stapleton used to distribute Robotics funds for her own benefit.
Now, what was revealed in the news, I didn't put it in the script, but I think it's funny. I know you won't. Federal investigators worked with the post office so that they could have her on camera, nice and crispy clear, when she was picking up the checks. And then they surveilled her to the bank as she was negotiating the checks. But nonetheless, it says Stapleton used the Robotics checks to obtain approximately $1.152 million, or approximately 38% of the funds paid to Robotics. She directed approximately $286,000 to Williams and Associates, a company she owned and controlled, $313,000 to Taste of the Caribbean, a restaurant she owned and her family members operated. Now, you're going to have to, at some point, laugh about this. $479,000 to a nonprofit entity Staple and Johnson operated together, and $72,000 to other parties for goods and services benefiting Staple and including remodeling work at her home. Please say this is funny.
I mean, no, it's not funny, but like, mate, is there a lesson here, Larry?
Well, the primary lesson is not to be a crook when you're in public office, because you'll eventually likely get caught. That's the lesson I would say, is don't be a crook. But if you must be a crook, you've got to get better than that. Can you think how stupid you'd have to be to direct all this money to businesses that you own?
I mean, that does seem a little self-serving and just on the nose, waiting for someone to nab you.
So, yeah, and the other lesson is that don't do this unless you enjoy serving prison time. She's 69 years old, and the federal judge allowed her to remain free pending sentencing, and she's a dual citizen, so I'm sure they took her passport from both nations. But man, if she decides to flee the country, that will be hilarious.
Perhaps we know a pilot in the audience that could be for hire. Who may be listening as we speak. Maybe. Alrighty then. So be better at thieving is what you're saying.
Well, I don't encourage you to be a thief, but if you feel you must, you really should reach out to me because I think I'm better at it than most people are.
Maybe we should have a little side program on how people could get in on this.
If you must do it, you've got to be just a tad bit smarter than that, and don't get arrogant. When you get too blatant with what you're doing, it becomes obvious to people if they're paying attention. If you're a big champion of all this funding, at some point, I would ask the question, what is in this? She's already on the APS payroll, and she's in the legislature, and she's, all righty, that's a little fishy to me, because I'm just a suspicious person by nature.
Well, then the one last thing that I got to say is, wouldn't this be club fed? I mean, she's not going to be in any sort of hard prison, and she's going to be at the lowest max that there is, and that would be club fed.
Well, ask Martha Stewart how club fed it was. She had just a 5-month sentence. This woman's going to get an 8 to 12 year sentence, in my opinion. And 5 months, Martha didn't think it was a club fed. She didn't pay dues, and she didn't ask to stay when her 5 months was up.
I see. I guess they offer that. Hey, you can get out if you want to. Like, yes, see me to the door, please.
Yes, I remember a program many decades ago, probably in the 1980s, where people were griping after the Reagan administration came to power about how nice some of the federal prisons are manicured and how that they are more like a college campus. And the warden said, yeah, he said, it's all these things are true. It's nice. It's well kept. He said, the people here are well behaved. He said, we pick the prisoners who want to just do their time. He said, but it is not a club fed by any means. He said, there's not a soul here that wants to pay dues to be here.
Very well.
Pennsylvania passed a law letting people verify by phone in under 2 minutes. State police then ignored it for 8 years, approving barely 500 people out of 8,000. Larry has a blunt theory about why they would rather see you in person. At higher levels, you can get one-on-one time with them. Become a patron at patreon.com/registrymatters.
This has been brewing for a little while about this Florida case. So are you ready to do this? Because we were going to talk about it last week, right?
We were. And
I deeply apologize for the whole desk thing. And there was just nothing I could do about it along with that. I had to go out of town, too. There was no time. I was out of time, man. So are you all giddy about this?
Not yet, but I might become so. But at this point, I'm not all giddy yet.
All right. Well, let's see. So I got the document in front of me, and I want to walk through what I think I'm looking at, because the caption is a mouthful, and it's styled Florida Action Committee. I got that part. Versus Mark Glass in his official capacity as commissioner of the Florida Department of Law Enforcement. And then it just keeps kind of going. It named, and I counted, 33 counties and 17 cities as defendants. Brevard, Broward, Calhoun, Citrus, Clay, and it doesn't stop. It just basically goes through the whole alphabet.
It's definitely a very ambitious and comprehensive lawsuit.
So the case is in the Northern District of Florida, Tallahassee Division, case number 4:26-CV-00388, and it was filed August 11th, 2026. And the way that I read it, and this is a big one, I'd say ambitious is an understatement. Florida Action Committee sued half of the state, and they laid out 6 counts. So walk me through what the lawsuit, and it says complaint for declaratory and injunctive relief.
This is the initial salvo. It's a complaint, folks. It's not a decision yet. Nobody's won anything as of yet. This is the plaintiff's opening filing. Every single sentence in this 61-page document, every punitive effect statement, every dramatic line about banishment, every map, all of this is an allegation and argument put forth by counsel.
And we're not talking about the decision from the court finds. We're not talking about anything. This is just an initial thing. So this isn't a court finding?
No, correct. It carries zero precedential weight until a judge adopts it. And no judge has adopted a word of it. This was just filed August 11th.
Which is 11 days ago as we're recording. All right. Now you say that basically it's nothing though. And I don't think you actually believe that, because I've heard you on the show for literally years now begging litigants to bring exactly this kind of case. So let me push back. If you know, respectfully, Larry, you're always telling me the losing cases lost because they showed up with adjectives and feelings and no evidence. You beat the drum that with the Nebraska situation. You beat it up with Beagle. So set the posture aside for 1 second and tell me straight. Is this filing built the way you would have been asking for, or is this more of the same?
Well, some goofball put no there, but yes, this is actually built the way I would like it. And I'm impressed so far with the lawyer. This is how you begin to build a record. And let me read you paragraph 56. And I want you to hear the difference between this and the stuff we usually complain about. Quote, the statewide residence restriction alone renders between 57% and 60% of all residential housing units in Florida legally unavailable to registrants, depending on how the authorities measure distances. And then they cited it with an exhibit, see Exhibit 3, declaration of Dr. Kelly Socia. Is that the way you pronounce it?
Works for me. It could be Socia, but I'll go with Socia.
Socia, however, that's a declaration from an actual expert with actual numbers. That's not just a lawyer saying, I got a client that can't live in 57% of the state. Well, how did you? Well, we figured it out. This is a person who has the skills, and they've done the research and done the work. And these people cost money.
And that's just the statewide law by itself, right? Because I'm looking at paragraph 57, and it gets worse. It said, once you fold in the financial constraints and the general rental availability, quote, an individual newly subjected to the statewide residency restrictions alone will be denied access to nearly, wait for it, Larry, it's not 99%, okay? I'll tell you that. It's not 99%. It's 98.9% of residential housing units in the state. 98.9%. And then in paragraph 62, it says, and I want to make sure I'm reading this right, 99% of residential housing units in Broward County are legally unavailable to registrants. 93% of Miami-Dade, 81% of Duval, 73% in Palm Beach. That's not a housing restriction. That's a wall. Now, see, I was going to say that if it says 57 to 60, I could see a court come back and go, it's not 100%, right? But when you say 99, dude, that's a problem.
That's beginning to be funny.
Not the choice of words I would pick.
But that's precisely the evidentiary spine that's been missing in a lot of the cases that have been lost. Remember, overcome the civil label to get a court to say it's punishment and not a regulatory scheme. Indeed, what the Supreme Court calls the clearest of proof of punitive effect. And you don't get there with poetry and with games. You get there with experts who measured it and can put an actual percentage on the map. Socia's declarations, the member declarations in Exhibit 5, the Feldman Declaration on costs in Exhibit 9, that's the record. Remember, you need the clearest of proof. And this time, they've brought some of it, and I'm sure they're well-equipped and prepared to bring more. That doesn't mean that we're going to win, but it means that we're going to stay in the game for a while on this case.
All right, well, so now it's story time, because I flipped to the middle of this thing and my jaw hit the floor, Larry. So on paragraph 60, subparagraph E, Brevard County. Tell the people what Brevard County did.
Oh, you found my favorite. You just go ahead and read it, because I can't read.
All right. Well, to quote, Brevard County retains a 1,000-foot exclusion zone from, quote-unquote, any school, daycare center, park, or playground, but recently permitted businesses to self-designate as parks for purposes of the ordinance, and then, quote, to date, at least 39 businesses have done so, including an art gallery and a clothing store.
An art gallery is probably not a park, but folks, you can't make this stuff up. A clothing store declared itself a park, and just like that, the 1,000-foot bubble opened up around it, and any registrant living inside that bubble is now living there unlawfully. Think about what this means on the ground. A person living somewhere perfectly compliant, and then a boutique down the street filled out a form and called itself a park, and now that person's potentially a criminal. They didn't move. The store didn't move. A piece of paper moved. That's the game, and it's rigged. I would like for listeners to understand that this is the plaintiff alleging that, but you've got the county's own portal right there in the footnote, so it's not made up. This is the county saying, this is what you can do here.
And it's not just Brevard doing creative things, right? Because I noticed the ordinances all over the map. Palm Beach went to not just 1,000, not 1,500, then they went to 2,500 feet, and then they reverted it back down to 1,000. Jacksonville adopted 2,500, then supposedly cut it to 1,500. But then the complaint said the code was never actually changed, so nobody knew the real number, what it was. Duval County, quote, Duval County's restrictions are unclear. How is this person supposed to comply with the law when the government itself can't tell you what the law is? Doesn't that make it like void for vagueness? Wouldn't that be a term?
It does, and that's one of the claims. That's the vagueness claim, and it runs all the way through. And it all dovetails with the loitering count. Let me read paragraph 70. I'll try, because this is one of the places where the plaintiff's lawyers did their homework. Quote, when asked to produce records identifying the locations that constitute places where children were congregating within the meaning of the section of the law, three county sheriff's offices expressly stated that it was a case-by-case determination made in the field according to the officer's discretion. And then most offices simply stated that no such records exist.
I'm sorry, wait. So there's a felony statute that says you can't loiter within 500 feet of a place where children are congregating. And when you ask the sheriff where those places are, the answer is, we'll decide when we see you?
Yeah, we'll know it when we see it. So can you at least laugh along and admit that one's funny?
It's not funny. Have you thought of seeking mental health counseling for your warped notion of something being funny?
No, I really haven't, because I think this is funny. You can't make this up. That you call the police and you say, y'all put your hand on the Bible and you said you're going to enforce the law, so I want you to clarify what the law is. And if they tell you that we can't tell you, you'll have to just take your chances and we'll make a case-by-case determination after you've taken your chance. That has to be funny.
Not if you're in Florida.
but that's the standardless sweep, and that's the vagueness argument in a nutshell. The statute didn't define loitering. It didn't define children. It didn't define congregating. The complaint actually went to the dictionary because of lack of definition in paragraphs 65 through 67. And the point they were making is that even Webster's leaves you guessing. And then they leaned on the city of Chicago versus Morales, quoting it in paragraph 68. And the definition of the forbidden conduct is not clear. And the quote, ordinance fails to give the ordinary citizen adequate notice of what is forbidden and permitted. Folks, when you're in the legislature, you've got to draft stuff so that people understand what you're requiring them to do or what you're forbidding them to do. Criminal law cannot condition liability, particular felony liability, on guesswork. And that's the theory of the void for vagueness. And of the six counts, I'll tell you, the vagueness count and the First Amendment count are the ones I'd hang my hat on, because they're the cleanest.
Well, let's do the travel piece, because that one actually kind of made me a little bit angry. Section 943.0435, subsection 7 and 8. The complaint said, if you want to leave the state for 3 days or more, you have to report in person 48 hours before you go and 21 days ahead of international travel. Fine, whatever, that's bad enough. But then you look at paragraph 50 and then again at 90, where they listed the sheriff's office hours. Would you do me a favor and read me what the Highlands County line says?
Oh, that one's funny. The Highlands County Sheriff is open for registration on Tuesdays only. One day, Tuesdays.
So if you want to leave on Saturday, you can.
and it gets a little bit better. The Baker, Charlotte, Columbia, I guess that's Glades, Lafayette, Liberty, and Manatee counties, offices are open for registration 2 days a week. The Jackson, Leon, Putnam, Sarasota, and Suwannee County Sheriff's offices are open 3 days a week. So it gets a little bit better. And the punchline, paragraph 50, it is thus impossible to comply with the 48-hour notice requirement, rendering interstate travel virtually unlawful. They say flatly unlawful, but I don't know if it's flatly unlawful, but it's very close to being unlawful.
And then if you'd be so kind to walk me through this, like I'm a registrant living in Florida. My mother dies on a Wednesday in Georgia. The funeral is Friday. My sheriff's office is open on Tuesdays only. How exactly am I supposed to give 48-hour notice in person?
You don't, because you can't. There's no window. The next Tuesday is after the funeral, and the complaint spelled this out in paragraph 90. Quote, if an opportunity for interstate travel arises on short notice, there's no way to comply, and the travel becomes categorically illegal. Open one day a week, and then you charge you with a felony for not showing up. Comply with that. That's the argument they were making. And I think it's a fairly strong one, because the law makes compliance physically impossible and then criminalizes noncompliance. It's not a regulation, it's a trap. Now the statute did have a wrinkle. They acknowledged it in paragraph 49, that untimely notice is allowed if the travel plans were, quote, not known within the notice period. But then look at what they said next. The in-person reporting requirement is not waivable. So the office is closed, and you still have to show up in person. And the knowing in advance excuse doesn't help you much if the door's got a padlock on it when you get there. I don't know how that would be of any remediation. Do you?
No. Could you leave a post-it note on the door? I showed up in person, and I put a post-it note and said, I'm going to Georgia. My mom died.
Well, if we were in the old days, I would say I would send them an old-fashioned fax, but nobody does that anymore. You might escape with an email, but this is very bad.
Yes, it is. All right. Let's get to the part that I think is the real fight, because you keep circling back to it. The banishment count. Count number one, the Eighth Amendment. This is where they kind of went big. And I have to say, the writing here is something. They brought in the Scarlet Letter. They brought in the Grand Remonstrance against King George. They brought in Roman law, exilium, relegatio. Seneca getting exiled for eight years. It's a whole history lecture. Does any of that actually help the guy who can't find an apartment?
Now that's where I have to put my discipline hat back on. The Scarlet Letter is entertaining. The Roman stuff, although I didn't understand it, it's entertaining. And I enjoyed reading it. But I want the audience to be clear-eyed. None of this, of that flourish changes your practical situation. And none of it is what wins or loses this case. What matters is count one of the paragraph 127 and go ahead and read it, because there's case law in this circuit already.
All right. Well, quote, in McGuire versus Marshall, and that's 50th Federal 4th 986, and that's the 11th Circuit in 2022. Did I do that right?
Yep.
Okay. The 11th Circuit held that Alabama's registration scheme did not impose punitive banishment, but that was because registrants in Alabama retained a meaningful ability to live and move within communities. Here, though, in contrast, the Florida scheme systematically eliminates those opportunities in densely populated areas and whole counties throughout the state.
Well, that is McGuire versus Marshall. It is the 11th Circuit, and Florida is in the 11th Circuit, so it's a controlling circuit for this case. And the 11th Circuit has already looked at Alabama's scheme and said that it's not banishment. And I'm going to go off script here a little bit. Banishment, a lot of folks in our audience, they say that they want interpretation to be consistent with what words would have meant when they were written at the time. That's the Scalia doctrine. Well, banishment in colonial times didn't mean that you couldn't sleep someplace. It meant you could not be in town. Boy, you need to get on out of here. If you're in town after sunset, we're going to lock you up, and you're going to rot in jail. That is colonial banishment. So if you adhere to the Scalia doctrine that the words have to be given the meaning as they were understood at the time they were written, and there's none of this involving garbage, then you can't say these people are being banished. Just because they can't rent an apartment and live there, they can shop and spend their money there as long as they don't hang out where children are. See, it's getting closer to banishment.
Sure.
Because they're not telling you, boy, you get on out of here. But if you can't be in any business establishment and you can't have a residence, it's getting closer and closer. But so you've got your own circuit staring you in the face saying registration schemes like this aren't punitive management. So you got to get around McGuire and the controlling circuit precedent. And you don't get to argue the beautiful Roman history until you've distinguished yourself from McGuire on the underlying facts of the requirements. So we've got to do a good job, and I say we meaning the people in Florida and their legal team, got to do a very good job saying, yes, you did say this, the 11th Circuit did say that, but this is distinguishable.
Do you think there's a difference in the way the population, what is the population of Alabama? 4 million people versus Florida, that's probably 40?
Well, there's some difference, yes.
Okay. So how would they try to do all of that? Because to me, it read like they were saying Alabama's different and our facts are worse.
Well, that's exactly the move, and it's the right move, and it's the only move. Their distinction was Alabama registrants retained a meaningful ability to live and move within the communities, and Florida's didn't. So they're already doing what they need to be doing, trying to distinguish. They're showing that 99% of Broward County is off limits, and that's what the maps were for. They're saying that whatever the 11th Circuit said about Alabama, Florida is a different animal. That is what they should be doing, and they did the right thing. And they actually put the words in paragraph 93, quote, whatever the 11th Circuit previously has said about Florida's scheme or the schemes in other states in the circuit, Florida's scheme today stands out as particularly, even uniquely punitive. So they weren't asking the court to overrule McGuire per se. They were saying McGuire didn't reach these facts. This is a distinction, and they're hoping that it flies.
Well, let me carry a piece of this myself for a moment, because I actually read the punitive nature section, and there's a legal hook I would like you to, Larry-splain for me. In paragraphs 115 through 118, they leaned on a case called Ellenberg versus the United States, and they quoted it a bunch. They said the consequences apply, quote, only with respect to a criminal defendant and only after that defendant's conviction of a qualifying crime. Then, quote, at sentencing, the registration requirement is imposed together with other criminal punishments such as imprisonment and fines. And then the other one that seemed clever to me was in paragraph 118. As a further sign that a PFR sex offender registration is criminal punishment, the registration regime is codified in Title 48 of the Florida statute, titled Criminal Procedures and Corrections. So they were arguing, look where the legislature filed this thing. It's in the crime and corrections part of the code. Therefore, it's punishment. That sounds like a good argument. If that's where they put it, then how would you argue it otherwise?
All right, that's the beginning of a good argument and the placement argument and its creative use of Ellenberg. But I want to be a little bit careful here because I've said this before about Ellenberg, and I might need to say it again. Don't get carried away thinking Ellenberg drags Smith versus Doe into the grave, because it doesn't. Smith versus Doe is still sitting there as controlling. The intent effects framework is still the framework as of right now. What Ellenberg gives you is a tool on the intent side of the ledger, of the argument that if the legislature stuck this in the criminal procedure and corrections title, and the sentencing judge is making findings about it, then the state's, it's just a civil remedial story, gets harder and harder to sell. But it's not a knockout. There have been many courts that have ruled that the placement in the criminal code does not transform a civil regulatory framework just by mere placement alone. But see, they've got a whole lot stacked. It's not just this. So they're doing a stacking, which makes sense.
And speaking of the state's story getting harder to sell, this is the part I actually want to react to, because you flagged it before we even started recording. The legislators, they quoted these people directly. Let me read Representative Steele, and this is in paragraph 98. He said, registrants subject to the residency restrictions, quote, shouldn't be allowed out of prison at all, and quote, should stay in prison, rot in prison, forever. And then in paragraph 102, he went on even further to quote, you know, I would love to see a sign that says, not welcome in the state of Florida, to quote, eradicate registrants in the state altogether.
They said that quiet part out loud on the record. Rot in prison forever. That's your regulatory intent there. But see, there's a slight problem with that, although it's good. that's one lawmaker speaking, that does not necessarily represent the intent of the body. At least that's how our courts have interpreted it here. But then there's Barney Bishop, the public witness, paragraph 13, and again in 102, quoting, just big unwelcome sign at the border of Florida and say, sex offenders, you're not welcome here. Go to another state. You don't have any rights. And close with a quote, we shouldn't be doing a single solitary thing to help them find a place to live in Tallahassee or in the state of Florida. They should be out of the state. So please support this bill. That sounds like that's pretty damning. Yeah.
And there's an older one too, right? From when they first passed the stuff back in the early 2000s?
Yes. Paragraph 103, Representative Susan Goldstein. Or Goldstein. What's your preferred pronunciation?
I would say Goldstein, because, Jewish and all.
On the original residency restriction, said it was diagnosed, quote, designed, quote, to get these people out of our neighborhoods and hopefully our state. Now, here's where that matters legally. And there is the point. The whole civil remedial fiction depends on the state saying, we're not punishing anyone. We're just protecting the public. But when the lawmakers themselves announce a banishing retributive purpose on the record, that fiction begins to get very difficult to defend. The intent effects inquiry can end on intent alone if the intent is punitive enough. If they can show that the legislature intended to punish PFRs, you don't have to go to the rest of it. You don't have to go through all that, the Kennedy, Mendoza, Martinez factors, because that ends the inquiry. If you intended to impose punishment, we don't need to analyze it. Your intent speaks for itself. So this was bad. There was a lot of bad faith bill drafting and legislative hypocrisy and just straight out incompetence. People that don't have a damn clue what they're doing.
And the human stuff is in here is rough as well. There's a veteran in paragraph 88 who survived combat, 3 ordnance explosions, came home, qualified for residential rehab with the VA, and couldn't use it because the facility was in an exclusion zone. There's the elderly registrant in paragraphs 87 and 88 who lived peacefully in Florida for decades and couldn't move into a senior living facility because there were no exceptions for age or disability. And then there's paragraph 84, the quote, roving encampments of quote, tents and makeshift shacks in a few parking lots in Miami-Dade because nowhere else was legal.
And an officer told one member of FAC, Florida Action Committee, paragraph 82, to quote, get a tent and head for the woods because finding compliant housing would be impossible. That's the on-the-ground reality this record has documented and attempts to document very well. Homeless rates from 7% statewide up to 34% in the big metros. That's the effects side of the intent effects analysis. And it's real. And I think these people have their act together. And this is not uncork the champagne, but they're being very ambitious.
Well, then here's a question, and it's one that a confused listener is going to have. They asserted 6 counts, and they kept using this phrase over and over and over and over and over. Unconstitutional on their faces in all of their applications. Every count said it. Is that a smart play, or is that them painting with too broad a brush again? And the way that you've complained about it before.
Well, I think that's a fair question. A facial challenge in all applications is the most ambitious thing you can ask for, to say that there's just no set of circumstances. You're not saying this just hurt my client in a specific way and it's unconstitutional, or saying that this law can never be constitutionally applied to anyone. That's an extremely heavy lift. I take the chicken approach to the argument it's unconstitutional as applied, but they hedged in a couple spots. On the laundering count, paragraph 142, they said it was unconstitutional in all applications. Quote, alternatively, they're unconstitutional at least applied to the innocent presence, to innocent presence. So they left themselves a fallback position. But the breadth is real. 50 plus defendants, 6 counts, facial challenges across the board. If a judge gets nervous about the breadth, they narrow it. I'd rather see them aim high and have some of the things kicked out than to go really timid and win nothing.
All right. Well, so give me the bottom line, because I came in kind of hot and I thought we won. You've kind of talked me back off the ledge a little bit. Where does this actually stand? And what should the guy driving to work listening to us right now take away from it?
Well, the bottom line is, this is a complaint. It's not a decision. Nobody's won. One thing on the ground has changed on August 7th when this got filed. Everything that horrible stuff we read about, the art galleries are still parks and the Highland County Sheriff's Office is still open one day a week. And nobody's going to see any immediate change. But I score cases on what the court actually orders and what changes on the ground. But this is the way you get to the outcome of having a winning, is you do the complaint right and you have prepared to go to trial if need be. I can just about assure you that they won't file a blanket motion for summary judgment. They're going to want to put some of this on trial. And I haven't conferred with a single person in Florida, but I don't see this as being, they may move for summary judgment on a count or two, but they're going to want to expose this for what it is, which just makes it impossible for people to live in Florida.
It does seem to do that. Now, let's see here. So what do you expect will actually happen with it? Do you think they'll win, maybe?
I expect that they'll survive motions to dismiss, at least on some of the counts. The vagueness, the right to travel, the First Amendment, which has a gag law component that we didn't get into. You can't talk to a minor, whether it's sexually or sinister, period. You just can't. They basically gag you from having any conversation with a minor. Those are the hardest for the state to create their way out of, because of the standard list. They didn't bother to define the stuff. So they crafted this stuff to make people feel good. And they assumed that the PFRs would never challenge them because they'd gotten away with it. The Eighth Amendment banishment count is a fight. And McGuire, of course, is going to be somewhat of a problem for them. But they may be able to weave their way around that. And I say that they've got some good traction here, potential, and that this case goes up to the 11th Circuit.
Now, and I'm just imagining that you are in town somewhere and you're window shopping or whatever, and a kid comes by and says, "I've lost my mom." Are you just supposed to run away?
Yeah, that's what apparently in Florida. now, but the irony of this is a state that promotes family values, and they need a mommy and a daddy, and they need role models, but then they make it against the law. It's funny.
And the kid has lost. The kid is girl, boy, whatever. They've lost their way, and they say, "Mr. Mrs., can you help me?" And you're supposed to just run away like the Roadrunner or something.
So,
and of course, the state's not just going to be like, "Oh yeah, you guys are right. You get all the things that you've asking for," and they're not just going to fold just to save the money, right?
No, not a chance. However much folks preach fiscal restraint in Florida, they will spend whatever it takes to defend the scheme. And here's the durability problem that keeps me from popping the champagne. Look at the history of the complaint. Paragraph 93, quote, "The original Florida registry statute adopted in 1997 as a mere reporting, and notice how over time, thanks to almost two dozen statutory amendments, grown more and more burdensome. From 2009 through 2018, the legislature amended the scheme seven more times. So if the plaintiffs win a declaration that is punitive, what stops the legislature from redrafting and relabeling, adjusting the distances and repassing it? They're not going to just throw in the towel, folks. They're not going to say, "Well, we're done." They're not.
Because that's what we saw with Michigan, right? Quote unquote, we won. And then the legislature came back and reworded things, or they were given a timeline to fix something and they just said no.
That's correct. And that's likely what they'll do here.
And this will be done, say, by Christmas of 2026?
No, this could take many years. So watch the docket. FYP Education will keep you informed. And I'm sure the Florida Action Committee will be diligently notifying people. And the rulings are what count, not the filing. But I like to win, and I'm not popping the champagne over this yet. But I give credit to the lawyer. I appreciate what they're doing so far. And I wish I'd have actually reached out to them, because I'm sure I've botched this somewhere, and maybe they can come in and clean it up on the next episode. But we did the best now, we could.
Well, and I always ask this question. This doesn't sound like this isn't a $20,000 or $50,000 case to hire an attorney, right? This is well in the six figures, possibly seven.
This is well into the six figures. I don't know about seven, but the folks in Florida are going to need to quit waiting to be saved. They're going to need to contribute. Other organizations that want to have favorable case law, they need to possibly pony up a little bit of help to Florida, assuming that things don't get dismissed, and I don't think it's going to happen. But if they survive and this case moves forward, then we all need to do what we can to help them, because we don't need a loss in a major state like Florida. If Florida can't win, then hardly nobody has a chance of winning anywhere.
They're one of the larger and more active organizations that there is.
So yes, we're going to be at this for at least 3 years, probably longer.
Well, then keep the champagne back there in the fridge there, Larry.
That's my advice. But also be ready to open up your checkbook if you have the ability to do so, particularly the Floridians that are listening. They're going to need all the help they can get.
Very well. Sounds good. Anything else before we head out?
No, I think we're going to be here next weekend again.
I believe so. Unless my desk craps out again, who knows? So head over to registrymatters.co for show notes and links everywhere. Email us at registrymatterscast@gmail.com. You can leave an old-fashioned voicemail message at 747-227-4477. And of course, as the people that are listening here tonight have done, they are supporters at patreon.com/registrymatters. And I would personally thank you from the bottom of my heart to become a patron. And then you can also head over to the FYP Education shop, and you can do that at fypeducation.org/shop for some fun swag. Larry, have a great weekend. Stay cool. It's probably starting to cool off a little bit, maybe.
Yep. Maybe. Down to 96 today.
Very well. Have a great night. Stay out of trouble, and I will talk to you soon.
Good night.
You've been listening to FYP.